I am sure that some of you remember the story of the emperor's new clothes. Hans Christian Andersen, who is a person generally only quoted in our society from behind a pulpit, told the tale of a ruler whose love of fashion was renowned throughout the land. He was consumed by a sort of sartorial gluttony, always going after the best and the brightest of designers. As it happened, a devious designing duo came to him with the groundbreaking fact that they alone had the capacity to design magical clothes. They could, they said, weave fabric that actually winnowed out the wise people in the world from the foolish ones. Once and for all, the emperor could know who was who, could know which among his subjects was truly worthy of favor and which ones could be safely ignored because this fabric, they said, was only visible to the wise and the worthy. The foolish people saw nothing there but thin air, but to the wise there was cloth richer than velvet and trimmings that dazzled the eye. Now, as you know, I'm sure, neither the emperor nor his closest advisors could see a scrap of the stuff, but nobody wanted to own up to being foolish. Nobody wanted to admit that they were anything but the wisest and most justifiably praiseworthy people in the kingdom, and so they said nothing. Nothing at all. Not when the emperor, who is always depicted as being a sort of portly man, preened in front of the mirror, wearing nothing but his bloomers. Not when the grand processional left the palace. Not when the emperor found himself to be curiously cold. Not at all. Though he walked through the streets naked, nobody said a thing except to go on and on about how lovely and grand his suit of clothing was. Until one small child, from out of the crowd, aghast at a sight he would prefer not to have seen, cried out, "But he has nothing on! He hasn't got anything on!" There are several morals that we're supposed to take from this story. I think I always read it as a parable about vanity, not just of the emperor, but about people of all sorts around the court. Each person clung desperately to their position in everyone else's eyes, as wise, as above reproach, even as they inwardly despaired of the truth of their foolishness. These days, I think this is actually a terribly sad story. Everyone there, inwardly convinced of their own inadequacy, certain because they could not see the cloth that it was they who had something to hide, certain that to speak the truth as they experienced it would out them to the whole world as a flawed and foolish person, everyone there was silent because they believed themselves to be a fool. To be honest, I think I spent the better part of my adolescence and perhaps my young adulthood that way. Fairly convinced that if I opened my mouth, if I spoke out of turn, I might out myself and everyone would finally know what I had always known, that I was not that smart, but a little bit confused, that I was not wise beyond my years, which FYI always feels like a backward compliment because how dumb are young people supposed to be? That I was not a good girl, but a scared one, and not even as nice as I always felt like I ought to be. Inside, I was, like most teenagers, complicated. I was jealous of girls who were prettier than me. I was utterly terrified of math, and I barely made it through advanced algebra, even though I was president of the National Honors Society. I had a weight loss goal taped to my bedroom lamp, even though I wore the crown of a hometown beauty queen. I still, in fact, have that crown, though it is a stand-in for the original because as I was awarding ribbons during the pig judging contest, my crown fell into the mud and was stepped on by a very large sow. I had to get a last-minute replacement before presiding over the demolition derby. True story. And through all that, a story not so much as original or unique, as merely representative of the complexity and craziness of the human condition, through all of that, just about all I ever heard from most people was how good I was, at least in the general sense. From this praise, no matter how earnest and honest it may have been, mostly all I got was a sense of a category in which I belonged. Specifically, the category into which I fell was that of the good girl, the smart one, cast over and against the bad girls, those other ones, the ones who got into trouble, who hurt people's feelings, who dressed in tight white Guess jeans and, you know, didn't have it all together like I did. That was all I knew how to be, at least in the eyes of other people. At least that's all I knew what to strive for, to be a good member of my category. And no matter what, no matter what I actually did, no matter how not together I might have felt or how dumb I believed myself to be, it was of the utmost importance to my adolescent self that I hold it together enough to stay within my category. When people said, "Oh, you're so smart," a twinge of physical fear ran through me. So afraid was I that someday they would find out I wasn't really everything they thought I was. It still happens sometimes. It took me years to realize that being smart is not actually an act, and that on the inside I am almost as put together as I try to appear. Not quite, but almost. Now, I know this story might seem like the ultimate of overprivileged sob stories. Girl who has a fairly charmed life gets praised. Continuing fairly charmed existence, girl fights to live up to that praise. Taking an admittedly bizarre but still rather charmed turn in life, girl stands behind pulpit proclaiming how proud she is to actually like herself. But there is reason to think that this narrative, no matter how much it smacks of self-indulgence and overprivilege, is not all that uncommon in our society today. There is ample evidence that many of us, not just children and adolescents, but people of all ages, find themselves in the role of the courtiers of the emperor who has no clothes. We are afraid to be outed as the people we really are. We are hesitant to speak the truth of our experience or confront the reality of our own limitations because somewhere, somehow, in spite of and even because of our very blessedness, we have become convinced that it is our job to be for the world a perfect representation of the category to which we have been assigned. I took the title of this sermon, The Inverse Power of Praise, from a chapter of Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman's recent book entitled Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. I picked the book up because as the parent of a toddler, there are things I am interested in that book. As I read it over, I realized that the message in this text has much more to do with every one of us than it does with just our children. It's about how we define ourselves and how we allow ourselves to be defined. By extension, it ends up being about how we find the courage to do anything other than what society expects of us, to take risks, to dare failing. It's about what we do in that rare and fleeting moment when we experience something true, no matter what the surrounding culture has to say about it. For most of the last decade, a researcher at Columbia University named Carol Dweck has studied the effect of praise on students in the public schools in New York City. Her experiments were done initially with a group of 400 fifth graders in the city schools, in which female researchers went into the classrooms and met one at a time for a nonverbal IQ test composed of a series of puzzles with each student. These were not terribly difficult puzzles, and when each child finished the test, that child was given their score, followed by, as the authors put it, a single line of praise. Randomly divided into groups, Some were praised for their intelligence. They were told, "You must be smart at this." Other students were praised for their effort. They were told, "You must have worked really hard at this." Then the students were given a choice for a second round. The choice was that one could take another test, more difficult than the first, but the researchers told the kids they would learn a whole lot from attempting the puzzles. The other choice, the researchers explained, was an easy test, just like the first one. Of those praised for their effort, 90% chose the harder set of puzzles. Of those praised for their inherent intelligence, a majority took the easy test. Why? As Carolyn Dweck summarizes it, when we praise our children for their intelligence, we tell them that this is the name of the game. Look smart, don't risk making mistakes. It turns out that those two lines of differing praise, "You must be so smart," and "You must have worked so hard," carry all the importance in the world. "You must be smart" is a very different statement than "You must have worked really hard." One is an inherent state. For the philosophers among you, because I know you're out there, it is an ontological condition. It is determined in the essence of the being, like you are pretty, you are good, you are bad, you are ugly, or you are dumb. It is a statement of absolute identity. It is a broad category that, while in this case is ostensibly good, is still inherently true or false, and as such is utterly outside of the person's ability to control. It is an identity imposed, which must either be fought against or lived up to, not an identity earned. And as such, it takes all the power away from the child, and it leaves them making safe choices, eschewing risk, in order to preserve the perception that they are smart and avoid at all costs the pain of a failure they cannot control or avoid through their own effort. But that other statement, "You must have worked really hard," is a statement specific to the moment. It is praise calculated not to categorize but to encourage, and the children who are working praised for working hard 90% of the time want the chance to work hard again. They want this chance because the thing they're being praised for is not their inherent membership in any particular category, but something they can control. It is praise that's in their power to earn. Praise, you see, is good, but it has to be the right kind of praise. Not categorical, but specific, not ontological, but of this moment. Dweck's studies show that this same effect can be found in students across socioeconomic classes. It hit both genders, but the ones who suffered the most were the very brightest girls. Of those, the very brightest girls, the authors say, they collapsed the most following failure. And the effect can be shown to apply all the way down to preschool. They collapsed the most following failure. That is haunting to me. If praised again and again for an absolute and inherent state which you have no control over, there is no wiggle room, no room to mess up, no benefit in pushing yourself, because when it all comes out that you're not perfect, not even an idealized form of a young woman or a young man, the inevitable collapse is profound, and it can be lasting. The effort that people, not just children, but any one of us, puts into maintaining our categorization and our persona can be crippling, especially to our ability and our willingness to take mighty risks. Some children, hearing over and over again how inherently smart they are, stop taking risks at all, steering themselves further and further away from difficult subjects, honest conversations, and an actual defense of their own values when those run contrary to the prevailing notions of those around them. Other children, categorized in other ways, as the bad boy, the stupid kid, the slut, make choices not out of their own volition, but because they are living out a hand-me-down narrative that has been given to them from sources outside of themselves. How many times have you avoided risk for fear that it might endanger your status in this or that group? How many times have I not spoken because I was afraid my opinion was stupid? How often do you lay awake at night worrying that the person everyone seems to think you are doesn't match up with the complicated soul that inhabits your body? In our reading this morning, Annie Dillard pointed out in her characteristically poetic way that any culture tells you how to live your life, to wit, as everyone else does. It'll decide for you what to prize, what is of value, even who you are. It'll give you a group to belong to and an identity to pursue. It'll give you everything you're supposed to be, but it won't give you an accurate depiction of who you actually are, just a generality, a category in which none of us fits perfectly, but which many of us spend our lives dancing into and out of. Our culture certainly has these messages presented to us all over the place again and again, even in seemingly innocuous ways. From Facebook, where we all construct rather more sanitized versions of ourselves, to MTV, the messages about categorization and type are everywhere we turn. Now, I recently, at the suggestion of my husband actually, read up on a feminist critique of the pop music phenomenon Taylor Swift. And this resulted in me watching the Taylor Swift video You Belong With Me, which is a lovely little song, essentially. But in that video, the virginal, pure, good girl wears a demure white dress and gets the boy in the end, while the bad girl wears red, drives a fast car, and shows some cleavage. A whole other set of categories about teenage girlhood is thrown around when a pair of dark-framed eyeglasses worn by a gorgeous young woman is supposed to convince us she's really a geeky, ugly duckling with no friends. The point is that human beings are not shorthand versions of themselves. They are complex and sometimes contradictory poetry. When we praise and criticize one another based on these imaginary types, we cram poetry into sound bites and we condense war and peace into a tweet. Instead of being the nuanced, troubled, remarkable, adventurous, ever-learning people we are called to be, we become encased in the fear that it will all fall apart around us, and we are afraid when we ought to be courageous. But there is hope, isn't there? It was a little boy from the midst of the crowd who yelled out the honest and revolutionary words, "But he hasn't got anything on." When everyone else was so afraid that they would be found out, never willing to take a risk, the little boy spoke the truth, and everybody knew it was the truth. And maybe it changed something. Because inside each of us is a little child who speaks when all are silent. Because even, or perhaps especially, the bad girls end up doing marvelous things. Because we are poems and not sound bites, we can be courageous, and we can lay down the burden of our own categorization and take the mighty risk of being and becoming ourselves. May it be so, and amen.